Welcome to The Brainstorm, a podcast and video series from ARK Invest. Tune in every week as we react to the latest in innovation and reflect on how short-term news impacts our long-term views. To learn more, visit ARK-invest.com.
ARK Investment Management, LLC is an SEC-registered investment advisor. ARK and Public are unaffiliated entities and do not have a relationship with respect to either firm marketing or selling the products or services of the other, and therefore ARK disclaims responsibility for any loss that may be incurred by Public's clients or customers. The information provided in this show is for informational purposes only and should not be used as the basis for any investment decision and is subject to change without notice. It does not constitute either explicitly or implicitly any provision of services or products by ARK. An investor should determine for themselves whether a particular investment management service is suitable for their investment needs. All statements made regarding companies or securities are strictly beliefs and points of view held by ARK and or show guests and are not endorsements by ARK of any company or security or recommendations by ARK to buy, sell, or hold any security. Historical results are not indications of future results. Certain of the statements contained in the show may be statements of future expectations and other forward-looking statements that are based on ARK's current views and assumptions and involve known and unknown risks and uncertainties that could cause actual results, performance, or events to differ materially from those expressed or implied in such statements. ARK assumes no obligation to update any forward-looking information. ARK and its clients, as well as its related persons, may, but do not necessarily, have financial interests in securities or issuers that are discussed. Certain information was obtained from sources that ARK believes to be reliable. However, ARK does not guarantee the accuracy or completeness of any information obtained from any third party.
Welcome to The Brainstorm, episode 72. Just here trying to have a normal conversation. You thought quantum was the big news from last week, but Brett is here to tell us why it's actually Relation Therapeutics' deal with GlaxoSmithKline. Brett, we'll start there. What was the deal?
I thought we were going to start with quantum.
All right, we'll start with quantum. There you go. All right, what was the quantum announcement?
So Google announced their next generation quantum chip that has twice as many qubits, but the big thing that they announced is they could, as they scaled up the number of qubits in the system, they could reduce errors more successfully with each scaling, which a lot of people took to be like, oh my gosh, this is it. It's the age of quantum takeoff. I think that it is useful and it is something, it is a necessary precondition to creating a scalable quantum computer. But if you look at the pace of progress in quantum computing, and then you like do like a reasonable estimation of how many logical qubits you need to actually hit some of these meaty commercial applications, we're still kind of in the 15-ish year out range for it to be commercially meaningful, assuming we get there. And for me, it's kind of like we've been in that 15 to 20 year out range for a while now, as in it doesn't seem to actually be tracking in. And relative to Google's even their 2019 chip announcement, I think they've actually tracked slower than they said they were going to, and so that's kind of the quantum view from my perspective.
Brett, two questions for you. One, just maybe pull back and explain what quantum is, a qubit, just high level. And then why exactly do you think it is tracking slower? What are the difficulties involved with quantum?
Well,
yeah, maybe we can get into all of the mumbo jumbo lingo that quantum companies throw around because they need to stay in existence for 15 years.
Yeah, at a high level, quantum computing is a buzzword that enables companies to raise money to try to do stuff and to sign marketing partnerships with other organizations that they dress up as commercial partnerships, but are mostly just a way to say, hey, we're actually doing stuff. So that's what quantum computing, for the most part, is for many commercial, supposedly commercial entities. The promise of quantum computing is, in a traditional computer, you have every unit in a computer is either a zero or a one. And so to construct logical operations, you have to be like, is this true? Yes or no? And then you create a chain of like, is this true or not statements to do all of the magical things like create this software that we're using to broadcast this podcast. The promise of quantum computing is with quantum qubits, it's called a qubit. Instead of having, it has to either be a zero or a one, these qubits can live in a state of both zero and one at the same time in connection with other qubits in the system. So they're all simultaneously kind of like, I'm both a zero and one at the same time. And
like a dimmer switch.
Like what? A dimmer switch?
Like a dimmer switch.
Yeah.
Well, Notebook LM said that was a good comparison.
Okay. I'm not, maybe, yes, sure. It's but instead of a dimmer switch, it is literally off and on at the same time. Like and also, so the problem with describing quantum computing and quantum mechanics generally is it is so counterintuitive and bizarre often your intuitions about it are wrong. And there's like all kinds of crazy stuff that happens in quantum. Like even so famously, Schrodinger's cat is the idea that you can have a cat inside a box that then there's a cyanide or some kind of aerosolized poison in the box that if an atom splits inside the box, it'll pierce that and then kill the cat. But because that atom is in a quantum state, like it both has happened and hasn't happened. And so the cat is both dead and alive until you open the box and observe, at which point it resolves into dead or alive. And so Schrodinger came up with that example because it is so bizarre and counterintuitive. He wanted to demonstrate how ridiculous a theory this was. But as it turns out, this is the way the universe seems to work. And so kind of like Schrodinger's cat, if you're doing a complex calculation, you actually, and it has a lot of like interlinked variables that you have to resolve at the same time. With traditional computing, you might have to go back and like serially try to change all those combinations to figure out what fits that complex calculation. In quantum computing, because all of these things can exist zero and one at the same time, you can almost have the conclusion determine actually what the zero one state is of all of the little interlinkages that lead up to it. And so rather than testing all of these combinations, you kind of resolve the answer all at once. And that's, once a quantum computer is sufficiently large, that's what it should be able to do. And it has, you know, practically the applications people talk about is you can break encryption algorithms that should be unbreakable with classical computing. You should be able to do amazing kind of material science advances because you can directly model the quantum processes of kind of like atomic coupling and molecular coupling. And then even in the AI training side, there should be also kind of advances in your ability to quickly train these very large models and all kinds of things. So if we were to deliver a commercial quantum computer, if we could transport one from the future to today, it would give us a supreme competitive advantage over everybody else with their stupid iPhones.
But it's like when I hear this news and everything you're saying, it seems the analogy I'm going to say is I'll tie it to like battery in 1991 time frame, right? So it's like advancements are still happening, right? This is good. It's certainly good, right? But it's not anywhere like AI today where it's like, okay, we know the access to throw money at to solve this. This is still like a experimental lab type thing where you got to work out all of these various elements before you get to real commercialization.
Yeah. And not only that, it's kind of like, you know, battery in the battery space, the similarity with the battery space is it seems like in the battery space, there's always a company that's like, hey, we have this new chemistry that magically has all these characteristics that you want in a commercial application. And it works in the lab and therefore this is going to become like commercializable. But going from the lab into production is you know, really thorny. often like the new chemistry works in all these different ways, but it's not necessarily something that's scalably producible into a battery. With quantum computing, it is such a bizarre and fragile space that they're operating in, it's very challenging to like know what's going to break as they try to scale these systems up. Like they have ideas of things that'll break. Like previously, it's like as you introduce more qubits into the system. So I mean,
it's more and more wrong.
Yeah, it gets more and more wrong, and so that was clearly bad. Now they're like, well, actually, we can do it where it doesn't get more and more wrong as we're introducing more qubits into the system, at least at this 100 qubit level, you know. So it's not that we're not talking, like, think about how many billions of transistors are on an NVIDIA chip. We're talking about 100 qubits here. And it's not even logical qubits. It's 100 things that then resolve into logic. So net, it's kind of extraordinarily early. I think what's a challenge in the space is there are companies that are trying to present it as commercializable today because they need to fund their R&D programs to continue developing. And so they are often saying, hey, we can do this thing. It's hard, at least as far as I've seen, I haven't drilled into one of those things and at the end been like, oh yes, I totally understand and get how this is valuable to the entity that's using quantum computing here relative to other options they could take. I can understand how it's valuable from a PR perspective, from both the person selling quantum computing and the people using it. Like, we're using quantum. I haven't seen any commercial application that then we could go and be like, oh, this is how big this market is. And it's a meaningfully large market. And so they are often selling this is early stage. The promise is just a couple of years away that we're going to do something that is meaningfully commercializable. But because it's a new, like, even to know that, you have to have the computer to then develop the algorithms that then can address that commercial opportunity. The acceleration in AI is actually eating up some markets that were supposedly going to be markets that quantum computing would be required for. And so I would not surprise me if, we're kind of still in this state of quantum computing being this promising thing. 5 years from now, we'll be like, yes, and it's still 15 years out. That could possibly be, you know, this perpetual moving to the right, because like all of the incremental commercial applications that you're going to hit with it get eaten up by the acceleration in AI. And so then why are you going to throw capital at quantum computing when instead you can get better ROI, like in things that actually work and deliver commercial capability today?
Right. Attention is all you need for fundraising, and that that has gone to AI.
Right.
Okay. Right. So then one of the applications of quantum is drug discovery, right? I think that's been one of the ones that's widely touted. But as you said, potentially AI eating low-hanging fruit for lunch. What was the announcement this week with GlaxoSmithKline and Relation Therapeutics?
Sure. And actually, even before we get there, you know, the promise with quantum computing is, hey, I can directly simulate the molecules. So I can tell that this protein plugs into this protein, or if I take the DNA read out, I can know exactly how a protein will fold and what it'll look like, because I can directly simulate the atoms. But AlphaFold, which is, you know, based on kind of the you know, cutting edge in AI, and AlphaFold 2 actually solved not all of that problem, but for like large classes of proteins, got very good approximate answers for those questions. And so kind of, yes, if you could have like simulation that was totally identical to reality, obviously we would like that. But you can get a lot of discovery done just by going, hey, I can just plug, you know, this DNA sequence into a computer and figure out this is the kind of like structure that I get on the back end. And then it's like, if I need to do further refinement, I can actually do physical kind of experimentation to understand what the structure actually is, so I can design a drug to directly plug into that molecular structure. And so Relation signed a big deal with GSK. It's possibly the largest kind of partnership with large cap pharma that a seed stage company has ever signed. And it's, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars per little target they're going after over some unspecified number of targets. And so why is GSK interested in this, and why are we interested in this? Generally, it's the of all of the technology spaces we cover, biology is the most data rich and the least understood. I think that's, I can claim that with a lot of confidence. And so, and it's least understood and also like really poorly executed upon. Like these are all companies that are setting themselves up to get into a virtuous cycle of doing experiments on biology that then gets them to drugs that are better than what's in the marketplace, less expensively and more quickly, and generates data that then refines their models so that then the next drug they develop, they can do even more quickly, more efficiently, and with a better kind of binding affinity to the thing they're going after. And so the difference is traditional drug development, including cost of capital, you might take you 13 or 14 years and you spend $2.4 billion to get a single drug to market. And so you have to, like, for that to make any sense at all, you need to have like around $600 million in sales spitting off that drug at peak just to kind of like get a return on that investment. We think in future state with AI drug development, you could get down to $600 million to get a drug through the pipeline because you can shrink the front end clinical pipeline. And then because the molecules bind more completely against the thing you're going after, you don't have to deliver as much of the treatment to the patient. So you're less likely to trigger side effects and kind of you're more likely to get approved. And so you improve your throughput rate in the clinical trial side.
Brett, I have a question. Just what is the current state of play in terms of AI drug discovery? What would be the most famous drug that was largely developed with AI, either that's in market today or is maybe in some sort of clinical trial? I don't know that I've ever heard us talk about like a specific drug that was largely developed, but maybe it's too early.
Because it's too early, because we're basically just in phase two with these drugs. So we're estimating kind of what the cost efficiency is here, but there's still a pretty wide range in terms of how it plays out. What we know is that AI developed drug, the average drug after it gets out of the preclinical process and into phase one, 50% of drugs fail. Phase one is where you test whether or not you create side effects that are like, these are too burdensome, we're not going to continue forward with it. And a set of, I think it's 39 AI developed drugs that have entered phase one and completed phase one, only 12.5% have failed. So it's basically 4x better throughput in that first part of the process. And if you think about like traditional drug design, 70% of your spend goes on things that fail. So kind of like if... Even if you can just get through phase one much more successfully and everything else is the same, you still have a better return profile. To us, it seems reasonable to assert that, hey, not only are these going to be less likely to fail in phase one, but also because they've created this whole mechanism that finds like the best binding molecule to this particular pocket, they'll also be more efficacious. So they'll be more likely to succeed in kind of finding a dose that works and succeed in kind of confirming that it works over a broader population.
Another question in hearing you describe this, do you think that, because there's obviously different components of bringing a drug to market, you talked about how AI is influencing the discovery portion, but now you're talking about the testing phase. Do you think that's going to have to change? As in, I can imagine a future where you have all of these drugs at the same time being discovered by AI. I'd imagine there's going to be significantly more potential successful drugs in which you're throwing all of that throughput into maybe an outdated system that can't actually help. So does that have to change? And how could it change? AI, can that play a part? Can we like simulate this in a virtual environment, or does this have to go through the traditional rails that the system has set up?
That's right. Unity spins up an Osmosis Jones simulation.
Well, I'm just imagining there's going to be so many new drugs coming through. Like, that's a bottleneck. Like, just in hearing you describe it, I'm like, that sounds like a massive bottleneck.
Yes. I mean, one, you do need the FDA to be able to process the applications and spend a not unreasonable amount of time being like, we're looking at data. So I would say that's like there could be regulatory friction that impedes some of this. On the, you're not always, but I think you're probably always going to need to test in humans along the way. Like, we're never going to, you know, it's famously like we've cured cancer in mice dozens of times. The problem is like the mouse cancer is not identical to the human biology. And so then you get into the human and it turns out it doesn't work. And with these AI developed drugs also, there's always the risk that, you know, we don't think failure rate is going to go to zero in human trials. We just think it's going to get reduced, And actually, a big part of the clinical trial process is you have to find patients, you have to administer those. I mean, you know, people who are agreeing to take this experimental treatment, like, how do you find these people? How do you recruit them in? And also, you know, if you're doing a control group, like, you have to find some people who are willing to do this, knowing they might not even get anything. They're just going to like submit to it to get the non-treatment, which for some diseases, that's like kind of a heavy lift. Like, it's so burdensome. It's like, if I'm going to do this, I want to get cured, not wait.
Not be the control group.
Yeah, exactly.
Can I ask, kind of on Nick's point. So, right, just to sum up, correct me if I'm wrong here. We're going from 13 to 14 years to develop a drug that costs $2.4 billion total. That's inclusive of cost of capital. Future state, that's all the way down to $600 million, and maybe it's 8 years. Where does that money flow? Where's the value capture here?
Well, it's to the, AI drug developer platform, because what happens on the back end, imagine you're going after the same commercialization opportunity. On the one hand, you've spent $2.4 billion to get you there, and on the other hand, you've spent $600 million, your return on R&D dollar in the $600 million one is, you know, on the order of 8x higher than the traditional return on R&D.
And so this gets back to kind of what we've spoken about before. It's like nothing on the insurance side is going to change. It's like they say, okay, this is fine. We're still going to, it's like the end result is still the same. This isn't trickling down to more affordable drugs for people.
Well, where it could, like, if you imagine traditional drug developers, they know they're undertaking a, you know, two business cycle, $2+ billion journey to try to get a drug to market. They're only going to try to develop that drug against something that's going to yield them hundreds of millions in sales per year. Like, so there are certain sets of disease that are just offside. It's too small. Like, why would I'm not going to spend $2.4 billion to kind of generate $200 million in sales annually. That just doesn't make sense. Whereas if you're only spending $600 million, then you can go after, you can actually develop treatments for diseases that right now it's like, you can't underwrite developing a drug for it. And so the person just has to like deal with hospitalizations and everything else. So it could pull money from other parts of the system, from the hospitalization and administration side into drugs. Like, if you think of it, there's only in the US, I think it's 10% of health spend is on prescription meds. 90% is on chronic diseases and conditions. So that's like, we're heavily under medicine. Like, we're spending so much time kind of, you know, trying to
That's a bold take. You should take that onto X. I feel like my feed is the opposite. Everyone's saying we're over medicated.
Well, yeah, but I think people people look at the U.S. system and say, "Oh gosh, it's so inefficient," and it is. Well, where does that inefficiency lie? It's like, you know, hospitals are really high fixed cost things with huge administrative burdens that are designed to try to battle with insurance companies to extract the maximum possible amount of payments against all the little fee codes that they can write in when they have a patient come in. if you think it, like medicine administration is much simpler and easier to both kind of underwrite and do, like, and the rules around it are in some ways much simpler. Like, I don't know if you've ever gotten like from a complex hospitalization procedure, like the bill you get out on the back end is like an incredibly thorny thicket of line items that is insurance adjustments against various things for like hundreds, if not thousands of dollars, where you're like, I have no idea if any of this stuff was done to me, and I have no idea what it is, and I don't know how the insurers know that it was done to me or what it is, or how the hospital even keeps track of it, except they have an EHR system that like spits it out at the end to try to maximize their revenue. Like, that's what we need to like clip out, you know? And so if we can deliver like more precise drugs against diabetes and more precise drugs against, you know, to avoid kind of stroke and cardiovascular illness, that'll, you know, that's how you would get efficiency into the system, I think.
Brett, one last question. Just how do you balance or think about the dynamic between, you know, issuing medication versus, and, you know, we invest in a lot of companies that are trying to cure the underlying disease. So how, you know, in hearing you talk about diabetes, I know there's people also going after curing it, like just eradicating it from the individual. How do you think about that over the long term? Like, is this a binary outcome of we're able to cure most and then there's only a little bit left to, you know, issue medicine for, or is it, does, yeah, I'm curious.
Well, okay. So this front end drug development process can apply to cures as well. As in, so the, you know, there are two independent things that are both really interesting in kind of drug development, and in some cases they'll overlap, and in others they won't. But net, you know, there's a $10 trillion opportunity in curing rare disease in the U.S. roughly, like, and so then that's like. You know, now you could go about that, like everything gets cured. Some of it, actually, you need to have regular administration of stuff because you're not going to be able to change the underlying biology directly. You know, but, you know, net, it seems like there's a huge amount of money here. And like at a high level, if we're entering a world of abundance where like AI is going to deliver all this abundant everything and we're going to, you know, like lots of things are going to become very cheap because of technology. Like, where is the marginal dollar going to go? It's going to go on living longer so you can take advantage of all that cheap stuff. Like, so there's a whole market in longevity and figuring out how to deal with the disease that is aging that has yet to really begin to crack open. And that, you know, I think the billionaires alone will spend billions of dollars trying to do that. Because if you have $1 billion or $10 billion, what do you want? You want an additional year. You don't want an additional dollar. And so there's a, in some ways, like this market is the market that will soak up all of the excess capital once we've met all of our other needs.
And from a competitive standpoint, we've spoken about this with automation and saying, right, if everyone automates, do you get extra normal returns? It's maybe not because everyone's doing it, but maybe yes, if it's lumpy or winner takes most and something like that. Is this a winner take most, or is this 10 years from now, everyone's doing this? And so if everyone cuts down costs from 2.4 billion to 600 million, then it's actually not a distinct advantage to the drug makers anymore.
I mean, I think 10 years from now, everybody that's still alive will be doing this. I think there should be consolidation in the front end of the drug space on this basis, because the engine that these companies are trying to construct is we develop drugs, which then as we're doing so, it gets data that feeds into our model, which allows us to more efficiently develop drugs, get to market more quickly, and it kind of feeds itself, and you build up these franchises that just have like massive data collection engines that begin to accrue all of the capital because their return on R&D is structurally better than other people going at it. And, you know, now I don't know if it's like as concentrated as like big tech would be, where it's like you end up with two or three, but, you know, the biotech space is generally heavily fragmented on the front end. And I think you'll see a consolidation on this basis. You know, it's actually like drug development as a business for equity holders has been pretty bad for multiple decades, as in like return on R&D right now industry-wide is 4%. It's like, why am I investing in drugs when I can just like get cash off treasuries if I'm getting return on R&D of 4%? I'm spending $2.4 billion over 13 years you know, to get 4% compounded returns. It's not good business. And you know, between this and what's happening with cures, we think that's going to turn around. Not broadly. I think there's going to be a dispersion. Some will begin doing this and they'll get great returns on R&D. And then the other like legacy business model where you're 8 years into a pipeline that you're expecting to get commercial yield from 5 years forward, suddenly your marginal competitor just launched a product because they were on an AI pathway that allowed them to get into market in 8 years. Well, then that's all, you know, your whole program is dead. And so there's going to be like a real kind of like splitting of the market between those aggressively pursuing these strategies and getting good data collection engines going and those that are think they can operate on status quo ante.
All right. Just under 30 minutes. Quantum and AI drug development. Just another week. See everyone next week.
See everyone.
It's a pleasure.